It was just like a very short clip of us working at State Farm, and it had someone on the video like talking over the video, just saying that we were doing things that we weren't supposed to do, just lying throughout the video. And that's when I first found out about it.
In one of the videos we just watched, Mr. Giuliani accused you and your mother of passing some sort of USB drive to each other. What was your mom actually handing you on that video?
A ginger mint.
So there you have Shay Moss. And the way their lives were turned upside down, Professor Anderson, I mean, men coming to their homes demanding they come out. Talk about the significance of this. And now it's shown that the tape is doctored and Giuliani is admitting that he lied.
Right. And this is the kind of terror that is reminiscent of what happened during Reconstruction that led to the KKK Act that Trump is charged with. Because that kind of terror was the intimidation of Black people who were exercising their right to vote, the intimidation of Black people who believed that they were American citizens, the intimidation of Black people who were engaged in the electoral process. This is what was happening based on a lie, where Giuliani admits that he lied. Even worse, I have to say, is that these lies about election fraud, about massive rampant voter fraud, becomes the basis for the voter suppression laws that many states like Georgia then put in place. So you've got an incredible array of laws in place, pieces of those laws dealing with absentee ballots, dealing with drop boxes, dealing with mobile voting units, dealing with places like State Farm that Fulton County was able to use to deal with the fact that it had to close 90 polling places. And so this was a way to provide a way for people to be able to vote. So the state using Rudy Giuliani's big lie and Donald Trump's big lie to justify shutting down access to the ballot box to minority communities, because the vast number of drop boxes that were shut down after the passage of SB 202 were in the Atlanta metropolitan area. So it went from over 100 drop boxes to fewer than 25 drop boxes.
And I wanted to ask you about the people involved in these cases. Those are bringing them, judging them. The judge in the new D.C. case is Black. That's U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, Jamaican-American. Now, many of those prosecuting Trump are Black. Manhattan D.A. Alvin Bragg, New York A.G., Letitia James, Fulton County D.A. Fani Willis have all received racist threats. And then you have Patrick Labatt, the Fulton County sheriff, saying he's going to get a mugshot if he's charged in our courts. Can you talk about the significance of this, and then particularly Fani Willis and Labatt, who they are, since you're in Atlanta?
Yeah. So this is why you have this also this kind of massive pushback about Trump can't get a fair trial in D.C. He can't get a fair trial in Manhattan. He can't get a fair trial in Fulton County because of the Blackness of those spaces, and because Black people and Black elected officials are seen as illegitimate. Think about Trump with birtherism, with Obama. That was an attack on Obama's legitimacy, legitimacy as an American citizen, legitimacy as an elected political official. When Blackness becomes illegitimate, so I think about Mo Brooks, the congressman out of Alabama, who said that if we only count the legal votes, then Trump would be in his second term. So those legal votes are white people's votes. The illegal votes are those from African Americans. And so therefore, folks like Fani Willis, folks like Judge Chutkan, folks like Tish James, folks like Alvin Bragg, they're not legal, they're not legitimate, so they can be discounted. So when you get a charge that says, I want to change a venue to from D.C. to West Virginia, that is sending the signal about the illegitimacy of Black people as American citizens. This, again, is what happened after the Civil War, where the Ku Klux Klan rose up and said, these aren't American citizens. The 14th Amendment does not apply to them. The 15th Amendment does not apply to them. We can do to them whatever we want. And that's what you're seeing replicated here in the 21st century.
So now, Professor Anderson, there's a lot being made of all Trump wants to do at this point. I mean, he's made history every time here, and now the third indictment. And we're expecting to see the fourth any day now with in Atlanta. Is delay these trials so that if he were to become president or he had an ally who became president, he could be pardoned. But a president can only pardon on federal crimes. You've got Fannie Willis in Atlanta. That is not federal, that's state. So if you can talk about what we're about to see in Atlanta, the grand jury now meeting today.
Yes, so one of the things that Fannie Willis has been really clear on, she's like, we're ready to go. And so that means for me that an indictment is coming soon. And Fannie Willis doesn't play. She does not play. And so you can expect to see a really crisp, clean trial with locked in evidence. And if he is convicted here in Georgia, if an indictment comes down and he is convicted, then it means that he won't be able to pardon himself. And so part of what I also want to push back on is the assumption that Trump will win the next election. He is 60, I saw a recent poll that 63% of Americans do not like Donald Trump. And what that means then is that we have the power as American citizens to make sure that this man who attacked American democracy, who attacked the foundations of the rule of law, does not regain power and have the ability to insert himself in a place where we have an autocracy, where even the memory of a democracy will be abolished. We have the power to stop this thing by registering to vote and by getting out to vote and ensuring that Donald Trump is not the next president of the United States.
Carol Anderson, I want to thank you for being with us, professor at Emory University, author of many books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Coming up, we look at Niger. A week after a military coup ousted the country's president, one of the coup leaders in Niger has received U.S. military training, had met with a top U.S. officer at the U.S. drone base in Niger just last month. The U.S. trained officers involved with something like 11 coups in Africa over the last decade or so. Stay with us. Niger musician Mdou Mokhtar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Niger, a week after a military coup ousted President Mohamed Bazoum, the leader of Niger's new military junta has vowed to defy any attempts to restore the ousted president to power. ECOWAS, a bloc of West African countries, have threatened to take military action unless the coup is reversed by Sunday. That's August 6th. Meanwhile, the leaders of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Guinea have all warned against foreign intervention in Niger. On Thursday, President Biden issued his first statement on the crisis, saying, quote, I call for President Bazoum and his family to be immediately released and for the preservation of Niger's hard-earned democracy. Bazoum is a close ally of the United States and France. The U.S. has over 1,000 troops in Niger, where the United States also runs a major drone base. Earlier today, Niger's new leaders announced they would end military cooperation with France, which ruled Niger until 1960. On Thursday, thousands of supporters of the coup rallied to decry international sanctions being placed on Niger, which is one of the poorest nations in the world, despite being a leading exporter of uranium.
People are coming. The people are coming. And we're going to demonstrate to all the ECOWAS countries and all those who are taking unpopular and inhumane measures against Niger, which is in the process of freeing itself from the yoke of colonization.
We're joined now by two guests. Olayinka Ajala is senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Leeds Beckett University. His new piece for The Conversation is headlined, What Caused the Coup in Niger? An expert outlines three driving factors. He's joining us from Glasgow, Scotland. And in New Jersey, we're joined by Nick Terse, investigative journalist, contributing writer for The Intercept, recently revealed one of the leaders of the coup in Niger, the Brigadier General Moussa Salou Bahamou, was trained by the U.S. military, recently met with the head of U.S. Army Special Operations Command, Lieutenant General Jonathan Braga, at the U.S. drone base in Niger. African officers trained by the U.S. military have now taken part in 11 coups in West Africa since 2008. We're going to start there, Nick Terse. If you can explain what's taken place in the last week, and particularly the U.S. connection to the coup leaders.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on, Amy. You know, as you said, the United States has, trained a number of coup leaders in West Africa over recent years. And this is part of the U.S. security strategy. I mean, they've flooded this region, the West African Sahel, with a tremendous amount of security assistance, really since 9/11. They poured a tremendous amount of security assistance dollars into the region. They've built a plethora of small U.S. outposts. You mentioned one of them, the U.S. drone base at Agadez. They built up militaries in the region at the expense of building up civilian institutions and civil society. And this U.S. security assistance, U.S. counterterrorism paradigm really hasn't been successful over this time. Back in 2002, 2003, when security assistance to Niger first began, the State Department counted just 9 terrorist attacks in sub-Saharan Africa. Last year, in just Niger and its neighbors, Burkina Faso and Mali alone, the Pentagon counted more than 2,700. So you're talking about something like a 30,000% increase. So there's been a tremendous amount of security assistance poured into the region, but the metrics have all gone in the wrong way.
And Olayinka Ajala, if you can talk about the significance of that U.S. connection. I mean, on the one hand, you have President Biden saying he wants democracy to be assured, although he didn't, interestingly, say Bazoum must be restored. He just said the family must be protected and democracy must be preserved. But the significance of the U.S. connection, the French connection, and the fact that those who are involved with the coup are couching this as an anti-colonialist move.
Yeah, absolutely. The U.S. and France have significant interests in the country, military and economic interests. You mentioned the fact that Niger is the seventh largest producer of uranium in the world, and most of these natural resources are mined by French companies. So the citizens in the country are seeing a lot of military installations, the drone base in Nagades, lots of military formations around the country without substantive economic growth. So this is one of the reasons why we've seen quite large protests in support of this. So the role of the U.S. and France is one of the reasons, especially in terms of the lack of economic development, but increase in military development and association is one of the reasons why the citizens are actually revolting and supporting this coup.
And can you talk about who goes out in the street and also the U.S.-Russia connection? You had some out in the streets after the coup shouting, Putin, Putin. But who is going out and who is staying home?
Well, speaking with people on ground in Niger, it's almost half and half, but a lot of people who are supporters and lovers of democracy are afraid to go out because of the large military presence, especially in Niamey. So what I'm hearing on ground is that it's almost even in terms of people who support the movement, all support the military junta and those who are against. But most of the people we've seen protesting are the ones who are in support. So that is quite tricky. We shouldn't be fooled by the videos or the protests we're seeing. A large number of Nigerians are still in support of democracy.
Nick Terse, talk about the formation of ECOWAS, who they are. They are threatening to, I don't know if it's move into Niger, they said, to restore the president. Meanwhile, the leaders of Burkina Faso, Mali and Guinea have all warned against foreign intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Over the weekend, the Burkina Faso's interim leader, Ibrahim Traoré, who took power in a coup in September, made international headlines for remarks he made in Moscow during the Russia-African summit. He criticized what he called imperialist neocolonialism.
The questions my generation is asking are the following, if I can summarize. It is that we do not understand how Africa, with so much wealth on our soil, with generous nature, water, sunshine in abundance, how Africa is today the poorest continent. Africa is a hungry continent. And how come there are heads of state all over the world begging? These are the questions we are asking ourselves, and we have no answers so far. We have the opportunity to forge new relationships, and I hope that these relationships can be the best ones to give our people a better future. My generation also asks me to say that because of this poverty, they are forced to cross the ocean to try to reach Europe. They die in the ocean, but soon they will no longer have to cross because they will come to our palaces to seek their daily bread. As far as what concerns Burkina Faso today, for more than 8 years we've been confronted with the most barbaric and the most violent form of imperialist neocolonialism. Slavery continues to impose itself on us. Our predecessors taught us one thing. A slave who cannot assume his own revolt does not deserve to be pitied. We do not feel sorry for ourselves. We do not ask anyone to feel sorry for us. The people of Burkina Faso have decided to fight against terrorism in order to relaunch their development.
That's Burkina Faso's interim leader, Ibrahim Traoré, who actually is wearing a hat hearkening back to previous Burkina Faso leader Thomas Sankara, who was assassinated. But Nick Terse, if you can talk about what he is saying, and it's also interesting this has happened at the Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg that Putin addressed. Far fewer leaders from Africa came than last time.
That's right. You know, I actually spoke with a few sources of mine in Burkina Faso over the last couple of days. I've done some significant reporting there over the past years. And, you know, I've heard from some that that speech really resonated a great deal, that the anti-colonialist bent of it, you know, made a big impact on people. They thought it was a really strong speech. There is a great deal of resistance to French neocolonialism that the French colonialists passed there. I also have heard from people that you know they see the situation in Burkina as deteriorating significantly. in terms of both, the terrorist violence, uptick in kidnappings, and also in crackdowns of freedom of expression, freedom of the press. So you have both these things going on there. There are some that really support the government and believe there's more behind this type of rhetoric, and then others who say that this is a smokescreen and it's just entrenching the power of a military junta that really isn't so interested in fighting against colonialism, neocolonialism, but more interested in entrenching its own power and using that rhetoric for its own benefit.
So if you can talk more about the U.S. training that goes on of African leaders, talk more about Secretary of State Blinken just having visited Niger and the significance of this drone base, where it's used, the one in Niger, how the U.S. uses it as a launching pad in the world.
Yes, Airbase 201. It's located in Agadez, which is in the central north of the country, and this is really the linchpin of U.S. military outposts, which have proliferated over the last several years in West Africa. This is a surveillance hub. It's used for anti-terrorist activities. As you said, drones are launched from here, including armed drones, MQ-9 Reapers. So this is an exceptionally important base. It was built at a price tag of over $110 million and maintained each year at a price tag of about $20 to $30 million. So it's a significant facility. The U.S. Africa Command, the umbrella military organization for U.S. military activity on the continent, they often claim that these aren't U.S. bases, that the U.S. doesn't have bases in Africa outside of Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti. I've been to Airbase 201. They wouldn't let me on board it, on board the base. But I traveled to its gates and I observed it, from the ground and from the air. This is a substantial military base. There's no other word for it. And I think the United States is now doing everything it can to make sure that it can continue operations there. You mentioned Secretary Blinken. He and the State Department as a whole tried to stay away, I think, from calling this a coup when it's quite obviously one. But I think they want to keep their options open. Once a coup is declared, the U.S. is supposed to stop most of its security assistance. There are ways around that. There are loopholes. I've reported recently that in neighboring Mali, where you have a U.S.-led junta there, there is still some trickle of security aid flowing. The United States finds a way when it needs to, but Niger is so central to the counterterrorism paradigm and security interests in the region. I think they'll do everything they can to keep Airbase 201 in action and as much U.S. military presence there as possible.
And Olayinka Ajala, it's interesting that it's Guinea, Burkina Faso, and Mali that are warning against military intervention by ECOWAS. ECOWAS did not speak out in all of the cases of their coups. Do you think that has emboldened the junta in Niger to take over? And what would an ECOWAS intervention look like? And if you can talk about how ECOWAS has seen the African military alliance in Africa.
Absolutely. That was what I mentioned in the piece, which I wrote earlier in the week, where I stated that one of the reasons for this coup was because ECOWAS did not really do anything significant to deter other countries from the militaries from other countries from taking power. So when the coups in Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali happened, there were a couple of sanctions issued against the military regime, but nothing further was done. But we need to put this in context. One reason why Niger is quite different, in addition to the the country being allied to the U.S., the France, it's also the fact that Niger has land border with seven different African countries. So whatever happens in Niger impacts significantly on many countries in the Sahel and in West Africa. So this is why it is more of interest than the other three countries. I think in terms of what ECOWAS is trying to do, a delegation led by the former military president of Nigeria, Abdul Salami Abubakar, returned to ECOWAS headquarters this morning in Abuja without any significant progress. They didn't even see General Tiani throughout the visit. So this tells us that not a lot has been made in terms of progress or in persuading the junta to step down. There is a deadline of Sunday for them to hand over back power to Bazoum or else they face military intervention or the use of force against them. We don't know how this is going to play out, but it is going to be very bloody. The spokesman for ECOWAS yesterday said this would be the very last option, but any military attack would be very significant because we've heard yesterday the leaders of the juntas in the other three countries have threatened to support Niger, and they stated that any attack on Niger will be an attack on them all. So ECOWAS have to tread very carefully because it's a very tricky situation for everyone.
And the role of your country, Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, oil-rich nation, what it is threatening right now?
Well, it's really interesting because Niger is a very important ally to Nigeria, especially in the fight against Boko Haram and Islamic State West Africa province around the Lake Chad. So is an ally in Nigeria is very keen not to lose, especially in this fight, because the substantive gain have been made in the fight in the last couple of years, and they won't want these to be reversed. Also, in terms of the president of Nigeria, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, being the head of ECOWAS, he just assumed this post in the last few weeks and is keen to put a mark because he's issued very strong statements against coup, not only in Niger, but across the region. Interestingly, in his acceptance speech as the chairman of ECOWAS, he kept mentioning coup. Even before this happened. So this is in relation to what has happened in the other three countries, which I feel Nigeria felt it was a lost opportunity because if more pressure had been put on either of these countries or all of these other three countries, perhaps this wouldn't have happened in Nigeria.
And finally, Nick Terse, what do you think, as an American reporter on Africa, what is the American press and overall the press missing when it comes to understanding what's happening here and what can happen?
Well, I think a lot of times we're missing deep context on this. One thing that really stood out to me, the Washington Post yesterday published an op-ed by the deposed head of state in Niger, President Bazoum. And, he talks about it being the last bastion of democracy in the Sahel. When I was there earlier this year, I did not find it the most democratic state. If you read State Department reports, you'll see that there are tremendous amounts of abuses of the citizenry there. The military that we've been backing for years has conducted a tremendous amount of atrocities. And this has built a great deal of ill will within the military itself and within the civilian population. And I think what's missing is that type of context, the understanding of what pumping all of this money into the security apparatus in the Sahel has meant for the people there.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you both so much for being with us, and we'll continue to follow things closely there in Niger. Nick Terse, investigative journalist, contributing writer for The Intercept. We will link to your recent pieces. Niger coup leader joins long line of U.S.-trained mutineers, as well as soldiers mutiny in U.S.-allied Niger. And Olayinka Ajala, we thank you so much for being with us from Glasgow, senior lecturer in politics and international relations from Leeds Beckett University. And we will link to your piece, What Caused the Coup in Niger, in Expert Outlines 3, Driving Factors. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Vancouver Art Gallery presents the Vancouver-based artist Mary Corey's most recent work, I Love, in the gallery's first floor rotunda until November 19, 2023. Paying homage to the calligraphic nature of Arabic in her work, Corey draws inspiration from Henry Moore's sensuous sculptures and Zaha Hadid's organic architectural structures. To learn more about this exhibition, visit vanartgallery.bc.ca.